noticed that it looks a little bit like a blueprint. Something's wrong. And this is the thing that I keep experiencing in the work that I do with people who are working in government or in climate change or in sustainability projects, is that there's such an urgency to find a way to create goals and strategies and actions that in the illustration of the system that gets created, there is a loss of responsive relational process. And you're right, I don't really know what to do with that. I feel so awkward about it. The reason that I'm troubled by it is because I know that mistakes will be made, big mistakes, if, for example, let me give you a good example, which is that a couple of weeks ago I was at the Club of Rome 50th anniversary. And the Club of Rome, for those in the class who may not have heard of it, is an organization that for the last 50 years has been really warning global governments and finance world people about the limits to growth and how if we go beyond those limits to growth, we are going to experience the backlash of ecological systems that have been tipped. So at the 50th anniversary, now, first of all, I want you to take note that it's been 50 years that they've been saying this. So after 50 years, you have to start to wonder if maybe you're not saying it right. So I'm a member of the Club of Rome, and I've been following their work for a long time. And at the session, there were a collection of the world's climate scientists. Johan Rockström was there, people from the Potsdam Institute. There's been so people from all over the world, governments around the world, and the most respected scientists. And as I was listening to their presentations, I started to just sort of do a little bit of a zoom out and to recognize the tones that they were speaking in, the rhythms of the way they were talking, the aesthetic and the particular kind of mood that was conveyed by the various graphs and in their slides, what they were showing. And after 3 days of listening to these lectures and these presentations, I noticed a couple of things. One was that in 3 days, nobody had mentioned the family. There had been absolutely no reference whatsoever to mental health. No reference whatsoever to the fact that in the midst of climate change, there's also going to be culture change and how those two things are connected. There were people who talked about economy, and there were people who talked about mindset change, but culture somehow stayed outside. Family stayed outside. Mental health stayed outside. Even physical, sort of go to the doctor type of health wasn't really mentioned. So there's something about the way that this illustration of systems at an external level and the recognition of systems at an internal and more intimate level, that separation, I think, I would venture to say, is not serving us. For a couple of reasons. So I sent you two different styles of writing about complex systems. One were some stories. I hope you enjoyed those.
Yes.
And the other was a piece I wrote on warp data, which is sort of my new toy. And what I am trying to do with the work that I'm doing right now is to ask the question while I'm sitting in that room with the Club of Rome of what is it that I cannot say in this room? What is it that this particular kind of communication and this particular framing of systems is prohibiting me from adding in? What's left out of this story? Because, of course, when we're thinking about systems, there's not only the system itself, but the system of communication for expressing it. And the separation of those things is a mistake. So, what to do about that? Well, one thing that I would recommend as a beginning point is to start to think about the notion of innovation or change inside systems as a change in perspective and perception of what that system is. Let me reiterate that for you. Okay? Every organism at some point has to change the way that it is surviving, because the other organisms that it's in relationship to have changed. Life doesn't sit still. So the capacity for survival of any organism has to do with how it perceives its context and how it responds based on that perception. Right? So different organisms have different capacities for perception. Octopuses are built to perceive slippery rocks and water in ways that, frankly, birds are not. Right? There's different possibilities for perception. Now, if you think of humanity right now as an organism that is in a particular set of perceptions of its world, our survival is contingent upon being able to perceive ourselves in our world in a new way. Are you with me?
So far.
So how might we begin to think about what that perception is? Because it's not just a perception of the outside context. It's a perception of ourselves in that outside context. So I thought it would be interesting in talking to you today to think about how some of this complexity and systems work applies to your own sense of identity. With the idea that as we begin to notice the complexity of our own identity, there's the capacity to notice more complexity on the outside. Now, in my life, I had a sort of a unique upbringing. And if you've seen that film of me, then you've seen me running around with my dad at young ages and getting pretty deeply indoctrinated into complexity and systems thinking when I was, I don't know, 3 and 4 years old. By the time I was 7 or 8, I was helping write stuff about it. By the time I was 10, I was working with my dad's classes at university. not because I was a superstar, but because it's not so hard for kids. I'm saying that because the world that I was trained to see from the time I was little was a world that was built of interrelationships and interdependencies. So whether we were having breakfast or taking a walk in the forest or whatever it was that was happening in our household that particular day, any discourse or any conversation in which there was the remotest shade of reductionism was called out. Okay? So, you know, breakfast. What is breakfast? Well, breakfast comes from all over the place, right? Breakfast is a product of the soil. It's a product of, you know, generations of agriculture. Is a product of a cultural idea of grains and yogurts. Breakfast is so much more than just whatever happens to be on the table on your way to school in the morning. And whatever conversation was going on, that intonation was always there. So I came to this sort of thinking from the inside. It wasn't something that was separate for me. It wasn't as though I learned about systems thinking as something that was a kind of theoretical world that you apply to a particular set of professional circumstances. For me, systems thinking was life, period. It was about all day, every day, about every relationship and every conversation, and from the fish tank to the dog to the math homework to the cereal at the breakfast table, everything was in a state of interdependency. And you might think to yourself, oh my God, what a lot of work it must have been to get through breakfast. but the thing that I want to impress upon you is that there's a notion of this intellectual material as a sort of parallel philosophical academic pursuit. And what I think is really useful is to recognize that when it gets into your elbows, as my dad used to say, when it comes into your actual life, that's when you've got it. If you're thinking about models and referring to definitions and thinking about it as a sort of theoretical body of work, that's great, and I know it's a lot of fun to do that. But ultimately, this is about the way you see yourself in every aspect of your life. So touching on identity, I think, is a good place to begin. So you may have noticed in the warm data piece that I started using this word transcontextual. And I began using the word transcontextual. I got it out of Sex and Ecology of Mind. My father used it first in there. And I must have read over that chapter, I don't even know how many times, before I pulled that word out. But when I pulled it out, it was a key to a door for me. So maybe it will be for you too. And the key was to the door that allowed me to think about not only things being in context, but in things being in multiple contexts, particularly living things. And that complex systems are very rarely possible in a singular context. I would almost say never. So when we start to think about how we're going to describe a complex system, this notion of transcontextuality is an interesting multidimensional approach. So if you think about your own identity in those terms, so who am I? This skyey woman on the other side of the world. Well, I'm an American, but I also have a Swedish passport and a UK passport. I'm a mom, and I am a daughter. I'm a professional, I'm an author, I'm a filmmaker. I'm also some kind of 40 trillion organisms that live on and in my body. I am my language, my experiences, my ideas, I'm my education. I am my health. I am existing in all of those different contexts simultaneously. Right, so when I'm sitting here talking to you today, I may be speaking to you in a completely different way than I would, you know, talk to my husband, or than he would think about talking to my kids. But myself as a partner or a mother is not absent from this conversation. Right? One aspect of me may be featured and up front, but it is certainly informed by the other aspects and experiences of my life. So while I might think I can just separate my professional self, my teacher self, out from my filmmaker self or my more poetic self or my, you know, inner teenage punk rock self. Those aspects are in fact not separable. Now, the reason that that's significant is that in the process of thinking about the transcontextual description of my own identity, my gender, my religion, my sense of self-confidence, all of those things.
That's our radiator screeching.
I thought maybe there was
a fire alarm. No, it's just providing heat for the 20-degree day.
So, in each one of those contexts, there's very different relational patterns and different forms of communication taking place, right? The way that my microbiome is in communication with the ecology around me is completely different than the way that I am in relationship to my friends, right? It's a totally different set of contextual processes and relational processes. And yet, they absolutely inform one another. So, this recognition of the self as a transcontextual process is, I think, a useful approach to recognizing how complexity is moving inside all of us as individuals. And within that, it is an invitation to see it in others. are in such a familiar relationship with, you've known them your whole life, and you start to think about how their complexity, what are the transcontextual processes of that person that you can perceive? And then think about, you know, the bus driver or someone you barely know at all. And begin to recognize that that person also is comprised of a very complex transcontextual identity. The way that I like to think of this is sort of like in the Native American tradition and in other indigenous traditions, there is the notion of a council, which is kind of a grouping of elders who converse or dialogue about what decisions to make, what to do next. And while your various contexts may not be elders, I think the sort of the visual of a council of contexts inside is an interesting visual to play with. It's an interesting idea that when you make a decision, what are you perceiving and on the outside, and what are your properties of perception on the inside? What are the contexts through which you're making sense on the inside? So there's really two frames of complexity that you're playing with. One is your own complexity, and then there's your own complexity and how much of you're able to perceive the complexity of the outside world. So the quick meme on this is that it takes complexity to perceive complexity. And if you go looking for complexity and you only have a academic theoretical model with which to perceive it, there's a lot of complexity you are not going to be able to perceive, because you aren't using your complexity to perceive it. So the more textures, the more rhythms, the more aspects of you, the more different sets of experiences you can use as kind of like sea anemone tentacles to perceive the complex world around you, the more you'll see, the more you'll be able to perceive. So that when you look at a model of a city and you see the list of the multi-stakeholders and you start to work on what their interdependency is, I mean, I know that's probably what you're working with, at least sometimes, right? That those stakeholders cease to be completely external. That you have something internal that can begin to map onto them. And you can begin to ask questions from the position of not who are the stakeholders, but what's the relationship between them? And to do that, you have to be willing to dive into realms that are artistic, that are poetic, that are emotional, that are irrational, that are intellectual, that are calculated, and allow those things to coexist, which is something that we are actually trained in school and in our professional lives not to do. Do not get emotional about it. Do not allow those parts of yourself that are illogical. logical to try to sense make a complex situation. And yet, in my experience, those have been some of the most valuable perceptions in the way that they hold counsel with more logic and rational perceptions. Okay, I'm going to stop for a second and let you guys ask questions, because I've given you a big chunk there.
Okay, you talked about how it takes complexity to see complexity. How would you originally get complexity?
How what?
How would you originally get complexity if it takes complexity to see complexity?
Well, I don't think that you can get out of it. I think you're pretty much stuck being complex from the get-go. So it's just a matter of how much recognition you have of your own complexity. So it's there. It's absolutely there. It's almost a mystery how we get uncomplex. How do we reduce ourselves and each other? Right? How does that act of reductionism, where when someone says to you, so, you know, how do you feel about this thing? And you just say something like, oh, you know, it's good, or it's sad, or it's interesting. And yet, obviously, there's so much more. Especially in Western culture, there's a tendency to reduce experience. You know, we say things like, you have the right to be happy. And in Western culture, happiness is kind of a monochrome. It's one emotion. It's one experience of, you know, smiling, cheery happiness. But in other cultures, actually, happiness is not separate from grief or confusion or anger or gratitude or fear. That you can't actually experience happiness unless you have with it these other experiences that inform the contrast. So, I'm not sure. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. What else are you thinking about here?
You said you're unable to separate parts of your identity. They all influence each other, which I completely agree with. However, I feel like at some points in your life, you are able to kind of distinguish like characteristics from different parts of your life. For example, like when you're with your friends, you may speak in a different regard than you speak when you're with other people, and so you kind of put a part of your life to the side. Do you agree with that, or what do you have to say about that, I suppose?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like I was saying, I think we feature different aspects of ourselves, depending on who we're with or what we're doing. But the other aspects aren't gone. They're just speaking less loudly. And the reason that that's important is that when you're asked to step up in some sort of acute moment and to perceive the interrelational processes that are taking place in a circumstance that you need to look at, you're going to need those aspects of yourself. It's part of this process of learning to zoom in and zoom out simultaneously. So you can see the interrelationships, but you can also see the details of each one. So in the stories that I sent you with the hitchhiker and the zombie, both of those stories are stories that are about a kind of presencing in which that wide-angle perception of interrelational process was so immediate and spontaneous that there was a capacity to respond in ways that were actually systemic in the moment. Okay? The trouble we get into is we want to solve a problem, we get anxious about the problem, and we eliminate the complexity. You know, it's interesting because there's a lot of fascination with the word emergence, and I'm sure it's come up for you in your class, as a sort of possibility realm of, you know, the complexity can offer all these relational emergence and things can happen. But, you know, actually, remember that emergency is also emergent. And in an emergency, the first thing that most of us will do is shut down that capacity for perceiving complexity. Is it right or not right? Is it life or death? Is it good or bad? Is it legal or illegal? And these binaries come pulling in those moments when we're afraid or under pressure. So those are particularly the moments when it's important to be able to perceive the interrelational processes that are taking place. Because whatever response you make, whatever decisions you make, are going to be informed by what you perceive, right? You are that organism in its environment. And your success is going to be premised upon how much complexity did you perceive? What were you able to come up with? Because the obvious solutions are not the obvious solutions when you're working with complex systems.
Challenges that this is such a wide-ranging conversation, figuring out what to ask next is almost its own complexity problem. I'll throw out a question just because it's something that is interesting to me. You mentioned your experience at the Club of Rome and the nature of these large-scale climate issues and sustainability issues is that for us as individuals, they're mitigated through institutions. And most Western institutions are designed to simplify, right? They're designed to reduce complexity so that a problem or issue that institution is working on becomes tractable for a kind of linear solution. And yet, and yet, the problems themselves are the result, to a degree, of that linearity, that thinking only in one way. And one of the things that I struggle with is the way that we move from an understanding of individual complexity to having institutions that respond effectively to complexity. You know, I think your idea of a council is fascinating, but bureaucracies are more than councils. They, you know, if you've ever read any Max Weber, it's all about sort of restricting the lines of possible action down to a very small number so that certain things can be achieved. And I'm wondering how to bring, you know, this is an enormous question, but it puzzles me all the time. How do you bring a recognition of complexity complexity to a set of existing institutions that are sort of designed to reduce, or, you know, intend to reduce the complexity.
Yeah, you know, I've been working with this for a while, and I don't know if you're going to like what I have to say about it.
Good.
But, well, my take is this, is that the more I have been playing with this warm data concept and looking at transcontextual process, the more what I recognize is how stuck the institutions actually are. So let's take, for example, the question of health, okay? Let's look at health through a transcontextual lens. So we're used to thinking of your health basically as being something that's whatever. Diet, exercise, access to medical, right? But actually, your health has to do with a lot of things. The health of your family, where you are with the financial demographics. Can you afford to eat? Can you afford shelter? Are you clean and warm and fed? It has to do with education and how people come through the education process, what sort of self-esteem or sense of self comes out of that experience in education. It has to do with your family and the way people treat each other in your family. It has to do with your culture. Your health has to do, in some cases, with your religion. And certainly with the laws and the policies of the community that you're living in. And so pretty soon, if you look at this idea of health through that transcontextual lens, it becomes very difficult to pinpoint actually which institution is mitigating my health. Where is my health? And what I've kind of begun to notice is that when you're dealing with complex issues like climate change, like health, like immigration, like gender, like like addiction, like all sorts of complex issues, that they don't really exist in any institution. They exist in the relationships between them. So whatever the culture is related to the, you know, employment patterns and the work hours and the expenditures and the stress levels and the way that families interact and the kind of food and safety and security, relationships to technology, all of those things are part of health. And on the one hand, that's totally individual, right? My health is my own responsibility. But on the other hand, my health is completely transcontextual in my community and in the biosphere, in fact. I mean, obviously, my health is connected to the fresh air or water or food or, right, those organisms that need to be in interaction. So where is it? And if you want to influence health, where should you poke? So for me, one thing that I'm starting to really look at is, you know the word liminal? Are you familiar with that word?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Liminal.
So the liminal space between institutions and organizations to look at. And there's no one in charge of that world. It's kind of a wide open new territory. But it gets to that question of how do we create the conditions for the relationships to change? Instead of thinking of our society with a bunch of institutions that are like the parts of an engine that you can fix or tweak, think about those institutions as being kind of the points through which contexts cross. And that's going to point us into this liminal realm. Obviously it's both. I'm not saying it's one or the other, but I think that this liminal space is a space that we haven't really explored yet, and that's coming from decades of frustration and waiting for incremental change inside institutions that just never happened. And the idea that we're going to, for example, let's say we're not talking about health, let's talk about education. So we want to improve education for a generation coming into a changing world. All right, where does that improvement begin? Where should we put that improvement? Is it inside the schools? Is it inside the employment opportunities so that we know what the schools are preparing people for? Is it in the intergenerational relationship between parents and kids and the expectations they have of their children? Is it political? Is it in the ecology? You see what I'm saying? The thing that you think you can point directly to and say, this is the problem and this is what we're going to fix, very often becomes more readily responsive to indirect relational shifting. But that's not the way we're taught to look at the world. We're taught to look at causation in so much as you see a problem and you have to fix it. So we see the larger problems of climate change. So for example, the use of fossil fuels. And the first thing that it seems we need to do is create policy to limit fossil fuel use. Right?
When the class talked about it in groups over the last week, that's one of the things they discussed. That's one of the places they targeted. Absolutely.
Right. So, I mean, it's the politician's job to, they have this thing called duty of care, right? They're supposed to show responsibility for the security and the safety of their citizens. And clearly, if there's no policy on fossil fuel use, the safety and security of the citizens will be jeopardized. Right? Seems pretty straightforward. So how come we've had 50 years of knowing this, and it's not changing? Or if it is changing, it's changing way too slowly. What's going on there? And if you put that question through a transcontextual sort of lens, if you look at it in the liminal realms, there's access to the kind of lifestyle changes, the kind of actual changes that limiting fossil fuels result in, where it's not just cars and lights we're talking about. It's agriculture, it's the delivery of our clothing, it's the manufacturing and the possibility to even have this glass of water. So, is that a political issue? Or is it strictly economic? Is it premised on a culture that is accustomed to consumption of products? Can we stop that culture that is in that consumptive pattern? I love you, radiator. It's like something out of... It's great. It's like something out of Hogwarts.
Yeah, no, it's I called it Moaning Myrtle the other day. It really is. Go ahead, please.
Right. Just this sort of notion that there are deep cultural interrelational processes that are tied into these things that prohibit politicians from being able to simply create that policy. And it doesn't mean that it's impossible. What it means is, for me at least, is that our approach to looking at how to think about systems change needs to be careful, and it needs to be as complex as the systems change itself. So I think that's our real challenge, is to bring that into focus in another way. What are your thoughts?
What are your thoughts? Yeah.
So you talk about how issues are incredibly complex and that there's no easy solution, because in the example you gave of climate change, there's fast fashion, there's fossil fuels. So it seems like a system thinker's work is never done. So in that case, how would you define success? If we were to limit fast fashion, but politicians don't do anything about fossil fuels, is that still a win? Is that success in your eyes? Or how would you define success of an issue, even if just a little bit is cured?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing, I love your question. Thank you for asking that. So you know in that zombie story, there's some little detail, this zombie detail, that is an unexpected. And that zombie detail comes out of the minutia of the story. Right? Did you guys actually read it?
Yes.
Or did I tell you the story?
Yes. No, you read it.
Okay. I wouldn't blame you if you hadn't. I just sent it yesterday, so. There are things that bubble up out of the minutia that link into this contextual solution finding, which is so strange, and I can't really describe how it happens, but in my work with systems change, every single significant systems change I've ever witnessed has happened that way, where there's some little something, and that turns out to be the piece that connects to the pieces. But you don't see it if you're looking at the problem and you want to solve the problem. It's because the problem is a symptom. So my feeling is that actually we will find a entry points like that. Danilo Meadows, I guess, kind of refers to those as leverage points. But I want to be sure that you that I'm clear that when you look at them as leverage points, it looks like they might be logical, right? But the reason for us continuing to use fossil fuels is actually not logical. So the reason to stop is probably not going to be logical either. And finding those entry points is kind of the artwork of the systems thinker. That is the creative process of the systems worker, whose work, like you said, is never done. So what is success? Success is staying with the trouble, staying with it until you find it, until you find the pieces. And recognizing how much more trouble partial linear solutions can actually be. So does that mean we just wait till the atmosphere fries before we do anything about this? No, not at all. That's not at all what I'm saying. I am one for a deep dive into the rigor of exploration of systems interdependency, and I just keep going. But I'm struggling right now with the, like you were saying, that there's these institutions that are designed to be linear, that we have deferred the mitigation of our lives to. And I, for me, this is actually a crisis of communication, of recognizing that these institutions are in the position that they are, but you know, what are they really? There are ideas in our culture, right? There are addresses. Inside those institutions are people. All the rules and regulations and bylaws and structures are created by people. So this should be software at that level. But they're not changing very quickly.
Do you have another couple of questions or comments? Lisa?
Yeah, I have a few questions reading of your two articles. So my first question would be, so as a systems thinker beginner, I'm curious about why do you call it the warm data? I mean, it's,
yeah.
How do you relate the warm data with the complexity of the system itself? The term warm data.
Yeah. So the term warm data comes, I mean, the warmness just comes from the fact that it's data that has its contextual relational process intact. So it's just, it's warm because it's in the company of its context. That's just where that term came from. But the second half of your question was, what is the warm data of the of a complex system?
Yes.
Yeah. So, okay. The way in which research has been done for the last several hundred years in scientific work is that things are pulled out of context to study them. And they're given definitions, they're measured, various experiments are performed and re-performed until they repeat. They should be able to be performed by multiple people and get the same results, so they are objective, that kind of thing. But when you're working complex system. What gives a complex system its vitality? What makes it complex? It's the relational process. So if you pull an aspect of the complex system out to study it, you won't be able to do any research on that relational process. The warm data is about understanding those relational processes, and they are slippery. They don't stay the same. When you are looking at a complex system, all the aspects of that system are changing in relationship to each other. They're responding and calibrating to each other all the time. Maybe it's very slow, like a forest, or maybe it's pretty quick, like an election campaign. But the relational process is making it so that you can't pull things out and freeze them and measure them and define them if you want to understand how they are in their complexity. So while the temptation is to map something and to make it solid in that sense, so that we can then create a strategy, the second you do that, you lose the complexity, and you lose the ability to perceive the complexity that actually the work that we do needs to exist within. Do you want me to give you an example?
Yes,
sure.
Yeah. Is the sound bouncing around? Is it okay?
No, we're good.
We're good. Okay. So, very often, in fact, most of the problems in our world are the consequences of previous solutions. And those were solutions that were considered without enough complexity. So let's look at Roundup, for example. Roundup is a solution to a problem. You know what Roundup is? Roundup is that pesticide that Monsanto uses. And Roundup has been a solution to problems of limited crop growth, to limited yield, to large populations not receiving enough food, to lower profit of agricultural companies. It's been a solution to a lot of different problems. And that solution was a disruption of another form of living complexity. Actually, several. So, there was this famous moment when the guy from Monsanto said that Roundup wasn't harmful to humans. Do you remember that? And he said he would drink a glassful of it. But then when they asked him to do it on TV, he wouldn't do it. But the point was that Roundup was developed as a pesticide that would only kill, it would disrupt the enzyme and proteins in these little tiny invertebrates, right? So it wasn't harmful to humans because we didn't have this same connective enzyme protein relationship that it was disrupting. So Theoretically, it wasn't harmful to humans. Except, remember, you're made of mostly bacteria. So, it was harmful to the bacteria that provides your microbiome and so on and so forth. So, it turns out with later studies that in fact this Roundup is disrupting all sorts of complex systems. It's disrupting the bacterial relationships in the soil, first of all, and then the large yield and forms of agriculture that it contributes to are disrupting communities and water sources. And then it's also disrupting, what was I going to say? So the microbiome, the soil, the community, and of course all sorts of economic disruptions, so that, you know, people who are growing things without the Roundup can't survive. So here you have it, where you get a solution that is it's perceived as being a solution to the problems, but actually it's creating problems because we weren't looking at the relational processes. So I was working with this woman in Africa, and she turned to her plate of food and she said, this is not food. And at first I was confused by what she was saying. But she said, food is made of relationships. Relationships between human beings and the earth, human beings and the seasons, between the various processes of bacterial composting and so on and so forth, between the songs that the people who plant the seeds sing to their children while they plant the seeds. Food is in the work of the basket weavers who carry the food from one village to another. And in those relationships, not only was dinner provided, but also all these other cross-generational, cross-species, cross-seasonal processes. That if you come in with some crop that will grow year-round, if you have the right pesticides and growth hormones in it, it's disrupted. So what's the warm data? Okay, in a sense, the warm data in that story becomes the relational work around what it is to plant a seed and get that seed from to dinner. So it includes the songs, it includes the basket weavers, it includes the times of year, it includes all of the processes by which the farmers figure out when to put the seeds in the ground and how to move the water. So that you get this more intact understanding of what that relational process is. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. And that's, we're just a couple minutes from when our class is going to end, so I just want to ask if there's any one last final question people have, or a burning comment.
Can I quickly ask how you transmit and communicate warm data? Because you can observe it in experience, but to share it with people who haven't been somewhere seems hard. I'm imagining like multimedia or a website, but that also seems thin compared to the depth.
Yeah, Well, yeah, when are you ever going to have enough, right? You're never going to have all of it. And how you transmit it, how you gather it, these are really good questions. And it requires another kind of research. So how long do you meet? Do you meet until Christmas, or is this a year-long course?
We meet until roughly before Christmas, yeah.
So maybe it would be interesting if you have another opening in your class schedule. I could instruct you remotely on how to do a warm data lab in your class.
That would be completely cool.
Okay, let's do that.
And I think we do have a slot over there. So, yes, we'll do that. I'll have Liam get in touch with you. Nora, I really want to thank you very much for the time you spent with us. And give her a round of applause. And we will be back.
Well, you guys are so patient. And I know that I've been dragging you through the misty forest of systems thinking today. And I know that you're getting the nice, firm, more concrete information from other directions, and so I see it as sort of my job to bring in the myth.
Good. We appreciate it. Thanks very much, and we will be in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nora.